Episode 47 with Johnny Perez.
Where meditation meets daily life, this is the Meditation Freedom Podcast.
Thank you for tuning into the Meditation Freedom Podcast. My name is Siko Rode. This podcast is about meditation, mindfulness, and contemplative practices. And in this particular case, Johnny Perez, the guest that I'm going to be sharing with you in just a few minutes, is someone who has spent a lot of time in solitary confinement, 3 years actually. And he didn't have a contemplative practice to begin with. He had to wing it on the go in solitary confinement. And so we'll talk about that as well as just the experience of being in solitary and in prison. And so even though he doesn't have a formal tradition or practice that he was using in prison, I think it's still very interesting how he coped and what he did to increase his freedom while in prison, and then what he did when he got out of prison. And Johnny has a lot of good ideas to reform the prison industrial complex. So a little bit about Johnny. Johnny Perez is a non-attorney advocate at the Urban Justice Center Mental Health Project in New York City. And this is a legal services firm that provides legal and social work services to people with serious mental illnesses. At the Urban Justice Center, he is assigned to the Mental Health Project's Safe Reentry Project, where he works with people with mental illnesses and histories of incarceration. He helps them connect to services in the community that will assist them to attain better measures of recovery and gain the stability necessary to avoid further contact with the criminal justice system. And through Johnny's participation in the Jails Action Coalition, a campaign for alternatives to isolated confinement, and the New York Reentry Education Network, he also hopes and works to change the unjust practices and policies in the criminal justice system. And he's also a member of the New York City Bar Association's Correction and Reentry Committee. Now, Johnny has gained a lot of insight in his 13 years of being incarcerated and his involvement with the criminal justice system directly. So another thing Johnny did was testify at the New York Advisory Committee to the U.S. Civil Rights Commission about the inhumane treatment of teenagers in solitary confinement in state prisons and city jails. And Johnny has also been a sought-after speaker. Johnny is currently working on his first nonfiction book called Prison, the Upside Down Kingdom. Here's the interview with Johnny Perez. Well, thank you so much, Johnny, for being on this podcast.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
One of the ways I like to start out is to just kind of get a sense of where you're coming from and what your journey was to get into the situation where you ended up in solitary confinement.
Sure. So when I was, I guess the first time I landed in solitary, I was 16 years old. I was detained on Rikers Island jail here in New York City for gun possession. I ended up getting sentenced to 8 months, you know, for having, you know, a gun on me. And while I was incarcerated, while I was on Rikers Island, I got into a fight with an individual over the phone. And if, you know, your listeners don't know anything about Rikers Island, they should know that if you do not belong to a gang, then you will not be allotted, you know, very simple, you know, entitlements that every person who's detained receives, like using a phone or using a certain bed and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. And I got into a fight over the phone. And as a result of that, I was given 60 days in solitary confinement. One of the things that made that whole situation worse was the fact that the person who was giving out the food when I got there, you know, and breakfast and lunch belonged to the same gang of the person who I fought. And for the first 2 weeks, I didn't eat breakfast or lunch because I was subjected to this person deciding not to give me any food.
Right.
You know, and, you know, as a 16-year-old, it was very, very challenging. And I went through a lot of, psychological, you know, kind of adversity, physical adversity as a result of it. And then as an adult, when I was 21 years old, I was sentenced to 15 years in prison for robbery in the first degree, in which I served 13 years out of that and a total of 3 years in solitary while I was, you know, serving that time. And my reaction was a whole lot different as an adult in solitary than as a teenager in solitary. So now, you know, years later, I'm a reentry advocate at a nonprofit law firm called the Urban Justice Center. And I've dedicated my voice, my past experiences, to, you know, creating alternative solutions to solitary confinement.
Right. And maybe you can tell me a little bit about what that was like to be in solitary confinement as a teenager and then later as an adult. What it's like to imagine for somebody who's never been there to be in solitary.
Yeah, so the cell is very small. It's very quiet. It's the size of, I want to say, maybe a parking lot and a half. It's very small. I'm 6 feet tall. I can stretch both of my arms out and touch both walls in a lot of the cells that I've been in. During the summer, it gets so hot that the walls start to sweat. And during the winter, it gets really, really, really cold. I find myself, you know, sleeping constantly with my head underneath the covers. Except that you can't do that because every hour on the hour, an officer walks by your cell to make sure that you're alive. And according to their protocol, they have to see your skin. You know, people should know that the light stays on all night and day. You know, the justification for that is for security purposes, except that it's very hard to sleep with the light on, you
Right.
know, and
It disrupts your circadian rhythm.
yes, greatly. To the point where, you know, if you combine that with not knowing what time it is, there are a lot of times where I lost track of time, even track of the days. You know, I try to create a calendar, you know, to kind of keep track of the days, you know, because one of the fears that I had was that I would be there for longer than what I needed to be.
Right.
As a teenager, 16 years old, I'm still creating my identity. I'm trying to figure out who I am, you know, and to be placed in isolation, you begin to absorb some of the oppression in a sense that you know, your self-esteem is damaged. You tell yourself, well, maybe I am a criminal. Maybe I do belong here. You know, you start having thoughts of, suicide in a sense, that you think about, hey, maybe people won't miss me if I'm gone and these kind of things. I felt myself as a teenager being very overwhelmed with anger. Anger against authority figures, anger against the circumstances, anger against myself. You know, I punched the wall a lot. I cried a lot. I did a lot of push-ups. I screamed. I yelled. I sang. And
And at the same time, you can hear people around you doing the similar type of things as well.
yeah, so although it's very isolated, you know, everyone in every other cell is doing the same exact thing that I just mentioned. So when you put all of these sounds together, you know, the sound itself is enough to drive a person, you know, to frustrate a person. You know, you hear correction officers who can't even stand the noise of even just working there from all the people, you know, screaming and singing and kicking their doors simultaneously. And other times it gets very quiet also. It gets so quiet that I remember I could hear my heartbeat that it was so quiet, you know? People should know that your last meal is at 4:30 in the afternoon and the next meal is at 7:30 in the morning, you know? And a lot of times you can receive a misbehavior report if you're caught saving food. And if you receive a misbehavior report while you're in solitary, it only leads to more solitary time. So it's not uncommon to find someone who is sentenced to 90 days for testing positive for marijuana and then end up there 5, 6, 10 years, decades even, from receiving these back-to-back misbehavior reports. You
So for
know?
holding a little bit of food, that's somehow a crime, even though in real life, nobody would even think that's a crime.
Yeah. So absolutely. And it's considered contraband. So if I save 4 slices of bread and my milk, you know, and then they come on a cell search and they search that. Not only are they taking it, you know, but I can receive a misbehavior report. And of course, it's up to the officer's discretion, you know, but I can receive a misbehavior report for, you know, holding contraband in my cell, you know, and there, you know, the department's ideology is that, you know, if this food goes bad and I eat food that's bad, then it's bad for my health. So they're protecting me and deterring me from doing something that's harmful to myself. Oh. As an adult, though, I didn't internalize a lot of the oppression that I faced. I actually became more extroverted and more outspoken a lot about the injustices and really began to question the system. I began to think critically about exactly why is it that we live in a country in which it's okay to do this to people, and I remember the only person that I had contact with was the same officer that fed me every day. And I did 3 years, a combined 3 years for a number of different infractions. Most of them were testing positive for marijuana. I think the most time I received or did at one time was a year, and that was for testing positive for marijuana. And I asked myself, why is it okay that, why we live in a country in which this is okay to, to do to people, and why are people not more concerned about this? And then it wasn't until I actually was released and started doing this work, I realized that people just don't know. So part of my job is to raise awareness about a lot of these issues using my own personal experience, to raise awareness, to educate, and to compel people into action, that this is an issue that is affecting about 100,000 people across the nation. 5,000 alone in New York. And we hear about a lot of the successes, but they're just incremental change. When Obama says, hey, we're banning solitary for juveniles, then later you find out there's only 27 juveniles in solitary on a federal level, then you ask yourself how much change is actually happening on this issue,
But that's just on the federal level, not on the state or
Exactly. Exactly. So, I always warn against incrementalism where we change, a small piece of the puzzle, but the entire picture still remains the same. And although, of course, no juveniles in the future will be placed in solitary on a federal level, that piece of legislation doesn't really do a whole lot as it relates to solitary reform. Now, I will say that some states have followed suit and pass their own limits on solitary on the state level, which we're very happy to see that, Virginia recently, banned juveniles with mental illness from solitary. Here in New York, we've seen some progresses, as it relates to how much time is spent inside of these cells. But, people should know that the UN rapporteur on torture not too long ago, Mr. Juan Mendez, he deemed anything over 15 days to be considered torture. And yet here in the United States, we hold people in solitary a lot of times indefinitely,
Yeah, the U.S. signed the Geneva Conventions.
Absolutely. Except that again, our system does not is not reflective of that. When you have a person like, let's say, Alfred Woodbox, who was just recently released, who did 42 years in solitary, 42 years. I have personal friends that are still in solitary from when I was there with them 5, 6, 10 years at a time in these human cages. So at what point is our system going to reflect our values?
Right. And in terms of your some of the reactions that people get after 15 days, I know I read hallucinations, increased anxiety, rage, anger, fear of prosecution, chronic depression, sleeping, self-mutilation. Is that, do you see that pretty much happening with most people or?
Yeah, it definitely happens with a lot of folks. And, your listeners should also know that sometimes, well, a lot of times, people are placed in solitary for completely minor offenses. 4 out of 5 offenses of people that are placed in solitary are for, minor offenses like testing positive for drug use, whether having contraband in their cell. And contraband can be tobacco, a frying pan, it can be cash, it can be a cell phone. And then they're placed in solitary. There are people that are placed there because of violent acts, but those are very far and few in between. While they're there, because we place very vulnerable populations in solitary, we place people who are living with mental illness who are in solitary. We place, kids. New York being one of only two states that places solitary kids in solitary. We place women who are expecting children. We place elderly people in solitary. We place people who are developmentally disabled. And while they're there, they I guess suffer the psychological ramifications of being alone. for extended periods of time, you know?
And are they following a protocol when they put somebody in solitary, or is this so totally up to the discretion of a warden or an officer?
It's both. A lot of times the facility has already outlined infractions or behavior that would land you in solitary in the first place, which we're also fighting that on that front, you know. We feel like people should not go to solitary for testing positive for marijuana. They need drug treatment instead. But then, so the prison has these guidelines, but then the hearing officer or the officer that even writes the misbehavior report in the first place, they have unwieldy, you know, discretion on who they send, how long they send them for, and even, you know, which type of solitary they send them to, you know.
So there's no like third party that reviews the rationale that they use to put somebody in solitary. Is that
So
true?
no, except that you can appeal the decision, except that on in practice, an appeal does not work the way that it looks like on paper. So for example, you know, you get sentenced to a year in a box for testing positive for marijuana. Then when you get there, they say, okay, here's your year and you can appeal. You have up to 30 days to appeal. Except that when you get inside the cell, there's no writing paper, there's no pen, you know,
Right.
the supplies only come by once a week, and you have to have it in within 30 days. You know, so a lot of times, a lot of the men and women are feel so defeated that they just don't even put in an appeal in the first place. For the people that are lucky enough to and fortunate enough to have the stars aligned to where they can actually submit an appeal, they find a lot of times they're often denied at the facility level, and then they have to appeal to the court. And the problem with that is that, you know, a lot of people in prison are not necessarily having taken a bar exam, you know, to present represent themselves in court. You know, they don't know about how to file an Article 78 or file these court motions. So they end up not winning their cases by default. Additionally, in New York State, you know, for you to access the law library, you have to ask, you know, for whatever you need 24 hours in advance. Then when you get a book, let's say like the Jailhouse Lawyer's Manual, which outlines different court motions in very layman's terms, this chapter is missing out of the book. You know, there's sometimes the book doesn't come at all, or the officer does not feel like giving out any law library materials that day or even that week. You know, so it really makes it difficult to appeal the decision and to kind of bring that decision in front of different eyes outside of prison staff.
Yeah, and you don't have any kind of representation that can help out with
Oh,
you
no.
basically have to represent yourself.
Yes. You definitely have no representation at the hearing stage, and even on the appeal stage, you know, and which is another issue that we tend to we try to fight as, you know, as the campaign for alternatives to long-term isolated confinement, is that, you know, due process, you know, it's not suspended without give. You can't, you know, isolate someone without due process. You know, we do it in our court system, you know, and except that inside of the prisons, due process is really non-existent. You know, we have people who can't speak English being sentenced at hearings that are completely in English, you know, and that's a problem. That's a huge problem. And people should be alarmed and concerned about what's going on inside of these prisons.
And this brings back to what you were saying earlier, that basically you're not treated as a citizen anymore once you're in jail. This message of you're less worthy than a citizen is not just literal in your face, but it's also in terms of trying to find representation or recourse.
Yes, absolutely. Unfortunately, we send people to prison. It's supposed to be as punishment and not for punishment, except that once people are placed there, they are, you know, faced with all of these different kinds of adversity, injustices, you know, and then it's justified by saying, hey, if you don't like it, you should have never came to prison in the first place, you know. And the problem with that ideology, I'll give you a case study, Mr. Khalif Browder, who passed away. And for your viewers that are not aware with the case, they should know that this is a young man who was 16 years old, who was literally picked off the streets of New York for accused of stealing a backpack. He is sent to Rikers Island, one of the worst jails in the nation, and spends 3 years while he was there, two of those years in solitary. Later on, footage, you know, was revealed that he was routinely pulled out of his cell by correction officers, beaten, put back in his cell. He was beaten up by gang members while officers just stood there and watched and laughed. He attempted to commit suicide a number of different times, yet he never received any mental health treatment or any psychological attention as a result of these suicide attempts. And then one day, they drop the charges and say, "We're sorry, we have the wrong person," 3 years later.
Wow.
6 months after Mr. Brado was released, he committed suicide.
He was permanently damaged in there.
Yes, he was permanently damaged. And I want to say that, you know, when we say, hey, you know, if you don't like it, you should have never went to jail. People should know that not everyone who goes to jail, you know, goes to jail for something that either they did, be for something that, you know, warrants the type of punishment that they receives. A lot of times the punishment is not proportionate to what it is that they're even being accused of. And in those cases where it's justified to remove this person from society, people need to understand that prison is the punishment. You know, they're not sent there for additional punishment at the hands of people who have sworn to protect them, which is what's happening right now.
Right. So getting back to when you were in solitary, how did you cope? You know, because, you know, you just mentioned someone who committed suicide, but you came out a different, you know, with a different maybe attitude or a resilience that you had. What was it that you had in that prison that kept you going?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I want to say hope. You know, I looked around my environment and said, people dying here. You know, I don't want to die inside of a cell. My mother did not give birth to me to spend my days locked inside of a human cage. And a lot of times people believe in you more than you believe in yourself. And for me, my source of strength was my daughter, who was born 2 days before I was arrested and sentenced to 15 years. And my mother, who has loved me unconditionally, even when I behaved in ways that I didn't deserve to be loved. While in the cell, not only saying, hey, I need to survive for them, you know, but also saying, I'm not going to succumb to this environment. You know, I dreamed a lot. I slept a lot. I fantasized a lot. I thought about winning the Powerball and how I would fire every single correction officer, you know, in the nation and hire new people who really care about people. You know, I exercised a lot. I also wrote a lot, you know. I wrote in the back of my Bible. I wrote in the back of books that I ordered from the general library. You know, I wrote on toilet paper, you know. And then all of these writings, once I accumulated them and got back to general population, I added them to my journal. You know, but this hope that I am more than just another person who's inside of a cell and have so much potential and I'm not going to succumb to this. And today I am who I am, not because of solitary, but despite solitary.
Mm-hmm. In the solitary, the writing is kind of a reflective practice. Did you have any other reflective type practices or did you ever struggle with a lot of thinking or?
Yeah, I know. So people should know, like, in prison, your memory fades. That's why people in prison like pictures, because it reminds us, you know. And there were a lot of times when I tried to think back to an event that happened, but I didn't remember it the way that it did, that it actually happened. And it wasn't until maybe I wrote my mother or something like that, and they would say, hey, Johnny, that didn't happen like that. What are you talking about? It happened more times than what I, care to admit. And part of it, I was thinking, hey, am I losing my mind in here? Am I creating these alternate realities and fantasies? Which later I found out, that's exactly what I was doing. See, for me to survive the environment, I had to get out of the environment, even if it was just psychologically closing my eyes. Mm-hmm. So the way that I survived solitary was by using my imagination. I see there was an article written on that process, by Nautilus Magazine, which I'll forward to you, you know,
great,
how we use our imagination to detach or escape from the environment so we don't succumb to the environment. you know, people who have gone through war and things like that, they also kind of use this same, I guess, visual exercises to kind of help them cope with the environment. And I was doing it without even knowing it, that I was doing it at the time.
Right. So you were, in a way, you know how a lot of us do meditation type practices to get beyond the walls of our thinking and the walls of our mind, as my teacher puts it. And, yeah. And so it sounds like your imagination allowed you to get past these walls that were limiting your thinking. And in many cases, people think very little of themselves. Those constant messaging that put us down, or, you know, or they would say put you in your place, but it really isn't.
Yes, definitely. And you know, and a lot of people that are placed there, unfortunately, don't have that capacity, and they succumb to the environment. You know, I've heard correction officers tell people once, you know, like a detainee might say, "Hey, I feel like hurting myself." And the correction officer might say, "Well, you know, come back to me when you actually hurt yourself." You know, I think about another case that happened, Mr. Bradley Ballard. You know, this was an individual who needed constant insulin shots, and the correctional officers completely ignored his pleas for him receiving his medication. At one point, one correction officer was kind enough to go to his commanding officer and say, "Hey, this guy, Mr. Ballard, in, I don't know, 23 cell, really might need some attention. We might take a look at that." And the sergeant tells the correction officer, "Is he dead yet?" And the other officer says, "No, he's not dead. This is why I'm coming to you." And the supervising officer says, "Well, come back to me when you have a body. Don't come back here until you have a body."
Wow.
2 days later, Mr. Bradley Ballard was found dead inside of his cell.
That's a real mean-spirited type of management. And was that systemic was that being taught in the culture of these prison officers? Because I know not all prison officers are like that.
You're absolutely right. It's not taught directly. You know, it's not a training on, you know, how to, you know, not have feelings, you know. It's more like a lot of officers, a lot of, you know, well-intentioned officers, which I've met a lot throughout my, you know, 13 years of incarceration. I met a lot of good officers, you know, except that they would rather not rattle the cage. You know, so they would stand by and watch injustices happen, but because they, you know, they value their job, or, you know, don't want to be fired or anything like that, they just don't get in the way of it. You know, officers are taught that we're criminals and we shouldn't be trusted. We shouldn't be spoken to. You know, we shouldn't be said hi to, and these kind of things, you know? So I want to say that it's definitely deeply embedded in the culture. Except that not every officer transcribes to the culture,
right.
At least not proactively, but sometimes just by allowing things to happen, you know, I would argue that it's also just as detrimental and bad.
Yeah, silence is also a choice.
Yes.
Yeah, standing.
Nice. I like that. Silence is a choice. Yes.
Yeah. So how would you go about if you were, because you mentioned treating people like people instead of, I mean, what is basically they're saying, the culture saying about people, the inmates is saying they're not people. And so then this culture of, you know, you can put them down because they're not people, right? Develops.
Yeah. I mean, look, and it even reflects itself in the language, right? You might hear officers say, "Hey, you know, how many heads do you have? How many bodies do you have?" Right? Completely dehumanizing language. And the problem with that, because it reflects itself in the language a lot, is that there's things that I can do to a criminal that I can't do to a father. There are things that I can do to an inmate that I can't do to a son, you know? And, you know, once a person is viewed in such a way, you know, then an officer feels justified and okay with you know, not giving you toilet paper for 2 days, or not unclogging your toilet for a week, or here's a cold tray of food. So what is 3:30 in the afternoon? I'll see you tomorrow morning at 7:30. Oh, you want to hurt yourself? Well, you'll figure it out. Don't come back to me until you actually did. Right. You know, and then justify it and say, well, you know, these people committed horrific acts and they should not be given any pity or any compassion, you know, but being compassionate or compassion is not something that you do, it's something that you are, you know? And I'm not sure if the Department of Correction like measures that on the way in, right? You know?
But have you seen any prisons where that is somehow being taught or instituted some way to make people more human rather than less human?
Yeah, there are prisons that I've been exposed to who treat people like people. And what that means is that, you know, they make sure that they have contact visits. They make sure that they have educational resources. They make sure that they have, you know, mental health treatment, adequate mental health treatment if and when they need it, you know, where they uncuff people during therapy sessions. You know, something just as simple as uncuffing someone during a therapy session goes a long way. Mm-hmm. You know, if you've never had therapy, trust me, it's no fun having therapy while you're handcuffed. You know, and, you know, really protecting and upholding the person's dignity and worth. You know, something as simple as asking someone how they're doing today goes a long way.
Right.
You know, and really acknowledging that person's humanity and presence. You know, in prison, how are you doing is not a phrase that is heard very often. You know, I want to say that here in New York, we have been moving towards that. A lot of restorative justice, a lot of, you know, step down programs from solitary. And giving people the opportunity to get these treatment and educational resources while they're in solitary, except that it takes legislation to move toward that goal and not just the sheer will of people, mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. Basically, prison used to be just punitive, but do you see it somewhat moving towards rehabilitative rather than just punitive?
Yeah. Right now, across the nation, criminal justice is very sexy, so to speak. You know, states are really taking a look at their systems and saying, you know what, is our system as humane as possible? And if not, we can make this better. And I'm just really glad and honored to be alive during a part where it feels like people don't want to be on the wrong side of history. You know, so we're seeing a lot of more progressive changes, you know, in different states moving towards not only rehabilitating people, but also equipping people with the tools, knowledge, and information to make them productive citizens once they return into society. In addition to correcting a lot of the systemic hardship also that people face once they're released, because it's not just the person, but also the systems that this person has to interact with, whether that determines whether a person recidivates or not.
Yeah, and so this rate of recidivism, a successful prison, I would say, that would be a model, would be one where the rate of recidivism is way lower and the prisoners correctly, you know, reintegrate in society and become productive, right? I mean, there's got to be models out there that would be worth following by other prisons.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know, when I think about, I'm not sure how I feel about the term successful prison. You know, I think about, I even ask myself, do correctional facilities correct anything?
Right.
You know, and sometimes when I'm speaking to different journalists, they say, well, Johnny, you know, prison was good to you. You know, you are educated, you're eloquent, you know, you work at a law firm, you advocate for people, and, you know, you do all of this, and you did 13 years in prison, you know? And I always say that we need to find a way in which we invest in people and not prisons.
Right.
So, you know, for the people that are impressed with my journey, I'm only an example of what happens when you invest in people, not prisons. I discovered the power of education while incarcerated. I took college courses while I was incarcerated. Now, kudos to Obama for, you know, the recent pilot program affecting about 12,000 people across the country who will be exposed to higher education in the form of Pell Grants. But a lot of that came from, you know, becoming who I am despite the adversity and not because of the adversity. And when I think about a successful prison, what it would look like, it would be a prison in which the prison invests in the people inside the prison and not in security or cameras or fancier handcuffs, you know, mm-hmm. and more like, hey, educational programs, drug treatment, mental health treatment. How can we empower this person? How can we make sure this person has housing and employment upon their release? You know, let's help this person make more responsible decisions.
Right. And would part of that be the solution be to take profit out of prisons? You know, because
oh, huge.
Because that's part of the problem, right?
Definitely. I mean, again, like I think about my daughter who's 15 years old, you know, and my future son, you know, and do I want to bring my future son into a country where people profit from incarceration, when people profit from oppression, when people profit from injustice, you know? And if I am up for parole and I come in front of a warden who is receiving money to keep me inside of a cell, you know, what is most likely to happen? What's least likely to happen, you know, and what's going to happen?
All right. If you were able to do that, how would you take that out of the equation, the profit?
I would definitely not allow any. I mean, if I had the power to, I would definitely not allow the privatization of prisons. Yeah. You know, I don't think that any person should, you know, be able to make prison a business. You know, even though state run, you know, correctional facilities also have a piece of corporate America in there. You know, people should know that, you know, people who are incarcerated, are, you know, work for pennies on a dollar, you know, I worked for 15 cents an hour for like, I don't know, for almost over 10 years. You know, doing work that had I been doing it out here in the world, I probably would have been getting paid $20 an hour, you know?
And yet you're still costing, you said, how much does it cost to warehouse somebody? It's like $170,000 or something?
Yeah, so Rikers Island costs $170,000 a year to warehouse and hold someone in these cells. And these same people work for 15 cents an hour, you know? And let me tell you something, when I think about that amount, right? If you give me a young kid who has made irresponsible decisions and $170,000. Not only would I give this person Ivy League education, buy him or her a nice home and a car, but I'll still give you back $100,000 left over.
Right. You know? So in the end, society would be way better off just investing in that person instead of investing in this prison industrial complex.
Yes. Huge. Huge. Definitely. And I ask myself, why are we not already doing that?
Right. Because you'd think some of the bean counters or the people that are saying money matters would say, okay, why wouldn't we invest the money in this person so we'll end up saving a bunch of money and rewarding wardens who help this person rehabilitate in a healthy way rather than giving them more money to keep that person longer in prison and costing more.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, and part of the problem also is just plain old corruption. Every now and then, the veil is lifted. You know, you might hear about a judge who is receiving kickbacks from a private for-profit prison for sending juveniles there. You know, and we're shocked when we hear these stories. You know, except that advocates or even the people inside of the cell saying, "Hey, wow, you're just now finding out about this." You know, right. And I'm just really glad that this is on people's radar. Criminal justice reform is on people's radar. And that people are finally beginning to be tired and don't want to be on the wrong side of history. Look, when you have the Pope and the president saying, you know, we need a better system. We need to reform our criminal justice system. You know, it makes people perk up and say, wow, maybe we are over incarcerating people. You know, 2.1 million people locked up in our nation's prisons. 65 million people have a criminal record on file. Most of these people are disproportionately people of color, you know, who come from low income neighborhoods, who have little to no educational resources, financial resources, you know, or opportunities, and ended up finding themselves warehoused inside of a cell for days, weeks, years, decades at a time.
Right. And like you said, the people of different races are being singled out versus, you know, if you weren't a college campus, somebody might, they get no punishment, but then somebody in a poor community does the same thing and they end up in solitaries.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think about drug possession and drug use, you know. I think about how, you know, I think about in my neighborhood, for example, there are 24-hour pawn shops and 24-hour liquor stores, as if people from my neighborhood have gold laying around to pawn at 3 o'clock in the morning, mm-hmm. you know. I think about the countless people that I know that have gone, you know, to prison for drug possession and have gone to solitary for drug use. You know, I've been to plenty of college campuses where drug use is rampant, you know, except that, you know, there no one ends up going to jail. But in other places, people do end up going to jail, you know? And a lot of it is not necessarily that people of color are singled out. It's that the system is one in such a way in which favors, you know, white people versus people of color, you know? And unfortunately, this is, you know, this is what goes on. I forget the young man's name who's recently in the news for sexual assault, who only received 6 months in jail.
Yeah, the guy from Stanford.
Yeah. And I think about if he was a person of color, will he have received 6 months in jail? You know, and of course, I would never know because he's not a person of color, but I would argue that he would receive a much different sentence than 6 months.
Right. Yeah, I believe it. What kind of challenges do you see right now for that you see ahead in with your job as a reentry advocate?
So there are a few challenges that I face right now in the work that I do. And that is to I'm always trying to humanize the people in prison. But the systemic change, right, the systemic change has to come from these different systems in which people have to interact with once they return in the society, and specifically parole or HRA, which here we call the Human Resources Administration, where people receive food stamps and different benefits and entitlements. Medicaid, you know, Social Security, you know, these systems really, work against the people that are returning back into society. You know, I have people who are being released who are given addresses to buildings that don't even exist anymore. You know, I have clients who, parole says, I do not want you to work. I do not want you to go to school. I want you to only take anger management. And once you've done with that, then we'll talk about you getting a job. You know, and that's a problem. That's a problem. That's a huge problem. You know, and, you know, the other part of the challenge is to changing the culture enough to where the policy changes. You know, a lot of times these policies are created by people who have no experience with the system, mm-hmm. have never been in the system, or have even come in contact with people in the system. And yet they're allowed to create policy for these people. And also part of my challenge is to, you know, really making people aware of the value of having the voices of people who are directly impacted in the work that they're doing when they're creating these, having these policy discussions, you know, because between theory and practice, there's a huge space. And in order to close that space, you need the voice of the people that are directly affected by the issue who have lived through it to right. tell you, hey, that policy doesn't look like that in real life. That's never going to work. But here's how we can make it work. And a lot of times we're excluded from these conversations because, again, you know, we're not seen as qualified. We're not seen as believable in a lot of senses. And just not really brought into the conversation. You know,
and so how would people be able to get you in those conversations?
Just invite me.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, legislators know, like, they know that there are advocates who are pushing for different forms of reform. We constantly contact legislators. We contact government officials. We contact people, you know, in different spaces who are either engaging in new initiatives or who are exploring ideas about, you know, whether alternative to incarceration, sentencing, bail reform, and things of that nature. And we say, hey, this is what should happen. So instead of saying, oh, thank you for your opinion, you know, just say, hey, why don't you come and join us for this meeting that we're having on how to actually formulate this?
Right.
I will say that it has happened in some spaces, specifically Rikers Island. I'm also on an adolescent advisory board here in New York City. I'm also part of the Bar Association. Also, I'm probably one of the only people who's not a lawyer who's on that community and reentry committee of the Bar Association. But they see the value in having, you know, the people who are directly affected being part of the conversation as it relates to reform.
Mm-hmm.
They've really come to terms of saying, hey, we're not going to get this right until we make sure that the people in the cell also have a say so on how this turns out. You know, in some spaces it's successful, and in other spaces, you know, you're invited, but you're not listened to, which is a whole nother issue.
Right. So it's just for lip service.
Yeah.
For show.
To say, hey, we had Johnny Perez there and he's formerly incarcerated. He was part of that discussion. But people might not know that every single suggestion I made was shot down.
Yeah. And so another thing I wanted to go to as well, this is related to where you said if you hand somebody a paintbrush, they're going to paint. Maybe you can expand on that a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for saying that. This is idea that people in prison are incorrigible individuals, that criminals are are born and not made, you know? And because of that, you have, you know, whether it's correctional officers or, you know, or legislators or even, you know, government officials who believe that people can't change, you know? And I would argue that people can change. I would argue that people can change so long as they're alive, regardless of, you know, age, you know? And, but because of this ideology, the idea is that, well, we shouldn't educate people in prison because if you teach this guy who's in prison for burglary, if you teach him computer skills, he's going to become a computer hacker.
Right. He'll just be a better burglar. Right.
Yeah, exactly. Instead, we should not teach them because if, you know, there is no change in this person. When the reality and the truth is that if you teach me computer skills, I may become a computer engineer or software engineer or an IT specialist. I'm not going to become a computer hacker. I'm not innately criminal or born a criminal. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So that's one. And then two, you know, a lot of times we kind of stamp people with this label based on one chapter or one act in their life, you know? Right. And for a lot of people, you know, the difference between a lot of people in prison and people in society is that the people in prison were arrested and a lot of people in society have yet to be arrested.
Right. Yeah.
I can't tell you the number of people that I have met who are either doctors, lawyers, you know, who have put their hand in a cookie jar at some point in their childhood or in their early teens or so on and so forth, except that they had the resources to not succumb to the criminal justice system and have this lifelong blemish or scarlet letter, you know, behind them, you know?
Or they simply just weren't found out.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, it never came to the light of day. You
maybe
know?
Because they weren't living in a neighborhood where the cops were watching them constantly.
Exactly.
You know, I think you're more likely to be found out if you're in certain neighborhoods. You grow up in certain places.
Yeah, and we know that, you know, street crime is prosecuted at a higher degree than corporate crime, you know?
Right.
I don't have to remind people about Enron and Mr. Madoff. I don't have to remind people of these things. You know, but those are far and few in between, you know? But the paintbrush piece is that, you know, I was at a Board of Corrections meeting and one person proposed an art program for people in prison, right? Art therapy. Who knew? Let people paint, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the correction officials says, we can't have this program because we can't give these people paintbrushes because they're going to create weapons out of the paintbrushes and kill each other, you know? Mm-hmm. And my eyebrows went up like, wait a minute. People don't automatically see a paintbrush and think, here's a weapon, you know? I mean, anything could be a weapon when you think about it. You can turn anything into a weapon. A person just has to decide to do so. So saying, hey, we're not going to allow people paintbrushes because they're going to create weapons out of it, you know, is to say that these people are incorrigible and can't be changed and are born criminals. When no, criminals are made due to a number of different, you know, environmental factors, psychological factors, you know, a lot of different variables go into that, not just born, you know.
And we also, we have a habit of telling somebody you're a criminal instead of you had a criminal behavior at one time. And that alone, that's coming back to the words, where words can be very powerful if you say your identity from now on is just that. Because then they might start believing it too, which also doesn't help.
Exactly. And I think that for me was true as a teenager. You know, I was, because the environment sent me messages, you know, solitary was sending me a message of, you know, worthlessness, of, you know, of, you know, this is who you are. This is how you should be treated. And after a while, I said, well, if I am a criminal, then you know what? Then I'm going to be one, you know? And real quickly, when you go into prison, you learn that, it's a completely different world. It's an upside down kingdom where everything that you believe to be true is backwards, like completely backwards. People do not value respect. People do not value diplomacy. People do not value walking away from a conversation. People do not value, you know, just being able to talk things out. You know, violence is really the law of the land on both the people who are doing time and the correction officers. They don't talk things out. They talk with their batons, you know, and you learn that for me to communicate, I have to communicate with violence. This is the language of the land here. And you know, when someone is constantly exposed to that 10, 15, 20 years, you know, then in return into a society, they still operating by those norms, you know?
Right.
And that's how this this cycle kind of continues, you know, this labeling cycle and, you know, labeling theory, if you will, you know.
In prison, did you also find a lot of people turn towards religion as a way to cope?
Yeah, I found that people turn to religion for a number of reasons. In addition to coping with the environment and this, I guess, unbearable reality, you know, and to kind of let go and let God take care of it, so to speak, because a lot of it, part of doing time is to come to terms with hopelessness, you know, and I know I mentioned hope before in solitary, but also hopelessness in the fact that there's nothing I can do about this situation, like absolutely nothing that I can do about it, you know? So all I can do about the situation is accept the situation.
So you're not struggling against it the whole time.
Yes, exactly. You know, and it's, you know, that's self-talk, you know? When I first went to prison, I had to tell myself, Johnny, you are not going home for the next 15 years. This is your home for the next 15 years. Stop thinking that someone's going to open your cell one day and say, hey, we're going to let you go, because it's not going to happen, you know? And I had to reprogram myself. And a lot of times it's saying, hey, God, there's nothing I can do about this. Please take care of it. God, if you give me another chance, I wouldn't do it again. You know, that kind of thing. So people turn to religion to help cope with the environment. And then people also turn to religion for feelings of warmth, feelings of, I guess, to feel inclusive and feel loved in a lot of senses, you know, and to feel like they're not alone, even though they're in a crowded room, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you find that that still goes once they reenter in society, that they maintain that relationship?
A lot of times, yes. A lot of times I've met a lot of people who, you know, who have found faith in prison, and then once they're released, they continue, they stay with their faith and their religion and things of that nature.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the ways I like to see the future too is that part of the problem, you know, we've talked about prison and a lot of the things that can be done to reform that, but then what about the root cause is that individuals to come to some kind of an act of crime in the first place. What can society do to address the root problem, basically, you know, where people start moving towards a burglary or any kind of crime, a life of crime to begin with? What can we do about that? Because that's really addressing the root problem.
Yeah, definitely. I think there are a number of different issues, and I probably won't even cover them all, but I think policing is part of the issue, you know, the way that some neighborhoods are policing, others are not. I mean, you know, in my neighborhood, I get mobile police towers. Other neighborhoods, they get community gardens, you know. Again, I have 24-hour pawn shops and these poverty pimps who prey on people needing things, you know, like Liberty Tax. We'll fire your taxes for $50 and all of this stuff. So I definitely think that the resources that are allowed in the community should be equal across all communities, except that is not. When I was 16 years old, I wasn't trying to decide if I should go to band camp or karate school. I was trying to decide which gang I'm going to join, how I'm going to run from the cops today, how I'm going to walk to school to keep myself from being bullied, right? And then when I was in school, you know, the messages that I received from my own teachers were not positive. You know, cut school as a teenager constantly, except that every year I find myself being passed to the next grade. And I'm like, how is it? I don't know how I passed this. I never did any homework. Mm-hmm. I probably showed up about 2 weeks out the school year. And here I am going from the 8th to the 9th grade, going into high school. And then from the 9th to the 10th and the 10th to 11th grade. How is this possible? And then as an adult, you realize that teachers were just passing the problem along. Mm-hmm. And I find myself in the 11th grade with an 8th grade reading level. You know, where the teacher says, hey, you didn't do the homework, it's okay. You'll probably end up in prison anyway. Right. You know,
so they'd already given up on you.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. Without a doubt. You know, and let's talk about the school to prison pipeline. When you go in school and school, our schools resemble a prison. I have to go through a metal detector. There are armed guards there. You know, I can be arrested inside of the school if the teacher, you know, deems that I'm being disruptive in class, you know, how I'm suspended constantly for, you know, might be behaviors that other students are not suspended for, you know. And the next thing you know, I have a criminal record from engaging in school. And then once I finally get in front of a judge for another infraction, I already have, you know, kind of psychologically been exposed to these restrictive environments in a sense,
yeah.
You know. I think the policing, I think the education, and again, I'll bring it back to, you know, the resources that are afforded in these communities, you know. I'm talking about completely. There's nothing for people to do inside a lot of these from communities.
Right.
You know, I wonder what would happen if we were to infuse these communities with the resources, you know, financial resources, human resources, opportunities, you know, for people to take advantage of them instead of feeling like I have to sell drugs to help my mother feed my three brothers.
Yeah.
You know, which is the reason the first time I went to jail, you know?
Yeah, I hope something like that happens. It is very complicated, of course, in reality, yeah, to try to implement that.
Yeah, and I mean more, and then, you know, we can talk about alternatives to incarceration, you know? You know, when people are arrested for certain crimes, they should not be going to prison. You should not go to jail for using drugs, mm-hmm, you know? You should not go to jail because your behavior was a direct result of your mental illness, you know? You should not go to jail because you were sleeping on a park bench and you're homeless.
Right.
You know, you should not go to jail for you know, hopping a turnstile on the train because you can't afford to pay $3 to get on the subway, except that you get arrested, fine the $100, and run through the system, you mm-hmm know? And I ask myself, you know, have we criminalized poverty? Have we criminalized mental illness? You know? And people are going to jail not because of what they've done, but because of who they are in a lot of different cases.
Yeah, that's a lot of things to ponder and to solve, a lot more problems to solve.
Yes.
And
yes.
It would be great. I mean, I just envision this, instead of an island with all these boxes in it, I have an island with gardens and a wood shop and, you know, every kind of possible skill that could be taught there. And then I imagine people coming out of that island way different than an island with boxes on it.
Yeah, absolutely. You take places, there's places in Europe, I think Sweden,
yeah,
one of the jails, like people are so humanized, some of the jails don't even have fences. And guess what? People are not running.
Right.
People are not running because there's no fence. You have places in India where the officers don't have handcuffs. Think about that. No handcuffs. Where people willingly go to the precinct with the police officer and are held accountable for their actions. You know, mm-hmm, so like we can rethink our entire system beyond what it is now, you know, in a way in which, you know, completely empowers people. It protects and upholds their human dignity, human worth, and is very directly reflective of our human and American values.
Right. And would be a lot cheaper.
Yes. And a whole lot cheaper. Millions and millions of dollars cheaper.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the last estimate I heard was a total of $81 billion a year spent on the criminal justice system as a whole.
That's amazing.
Yeah. $81 billion, police, corrections, and courts. $81 billion. Yeah.
And it just keeps on continuing this cycle unless you have people like yourself who have some, you know, advantages and fortunate enough to self-educate your way out of it, out of the cycle.
Yeah, and to have the support of people, you know, who say, we're going to invest in this person.
Right.
You know, this person has potential. And I'll tell you something that I told a reporter the other day from the Times was that, you know, the entire time I was in prison for 13 years straight, every day, day in and day out, not once did I meet a person who was incorrigible, who could not be changed, or who was deep down a criminal. I met people who had so much unrealized potential.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about so creative, so smart. I know scholars who don't have PhDs, who have studied subjects for the last 10, 15 years because there's nothing else for them to do. And they just study and are so smart, but they will never see the light of day. And I ask myself, imagine if the cure to cancer was stuck inside of a head of a person who's sitting inside of a cell who is not allowed, who is not being allowed the education to bring the cure into fruition.
Yeah.
You know, there's so much unrealized potential inside of our, you know, prisons, you know, that if we were to invest in these people, our society as a whole, not only the very moral fabric of our society would be upheld, but our society would be furthered by the accomplishments that these people would make.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I totally agree. And you know,
now,
yeah.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Do you have anything else? Anything else I missed that you want to get off your chest that you think people should know who are not used to, you know, that part of society, you know, being incarcerated? Yeah. And what it's like to be there?
Yeah. I think I kind of said it all, but I would just emphasize, you know, I would emphasize for your listeners who have never come in contact with someone who has been exposed to the system, which might be kind of difficult at 65 million people. You know, you might know someone, but, you know, people should know that a lot of the people in prison are there because they just haven't been given the opportunity to do better, and they can't do better unless they know how to do better. So definitely education is part of the conversation, you know? And then the other part of the conversation is that there are no bad people. There are people who may commit bad acts or irresponsible acts, you know, but we can't transcribe, you know, we can't subject one person, you know, to kind of regulate one person to just one chapter of their life.
Right.
You know, we've all made mistakes, whether we've been caught for them or not, whether we've been held accountable for them or not, you know, where this can be your reality. You know, you can also be subjected to this system. And the reason people should care is because 95% of the people who are in prison right now are going to be released one day, tomorrow, next week, next year. And they're going right into our communities. There's people in your community right now who have criminal records who you may even be surprised that have a record, but have never even mentioned it or even told you about it. You know, until we see people as people, then we will not treat people as people. You know, right. And I want to just thank you for, you know, not only holding this podcast, but for, you know, kind of bringing light to a lot of these issues, for giving me a voice, you know, to kind of help amplify my voice and reach a wider audience about these issues. Your listeners should feel free, you know, to find me on Facebook, Mr. Johnny Perez, also on Twitter at Mr. Johnny Perez. And also on Instagram at Mr. Johnny Perez, and also LinkedIn at Mr. Johnny Perez. I'm always available to answer any questions, and I'm always available to come and, you know, do presentations in person. I've traveled a lot across the country talking about this issue. So I may be at a neighborhood near you.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much. And I'll make sure that all those links are in there, and any other links that you have, you know, where people might be able to click on a link to petition their state or whoever.
Actually, it's great that you say that. People can go to NYCAIC.org, and that stands for the New York Campaign for Alternatives to Long-Term Isolated Confinement. They could read more about solitary there. They can read more about a lot of the changes that are happening across the nation. And they can also find out ways in which they can get involved. And they can also go to solitarywatch.org, which also gives you a lot of the same information that I just mentioned.
Great. All right. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, man. Thanks for having me.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Johnny Perez. And please feel free to check out the show notes and links, especially links where you can make a difference and help Johnny out. And the show notes are located at meditationfreedom.com/47. And as always, feel free to leave a comment, and I'll make sure to pass it along to Johnny. Thank you so much for listening again to the Meditation Freedom Podcast, and I hope you have a wonderful practice going, and may we have a world with less confusion and separateness. Take care.
Thank you so much for joining us on the Meditation Freedom Podcast, where meditation meets daily life.